All right, here we go one more time. Up the down staircase in the outdoor, doing some serious internal excavation at its finest. I will cut no slack before it's time. We're looking for the obvious buried in the absurd, and I will do everything I can to make sense out of the senseless. You know, for years and years and years, ever since you put a human in an automobile, we've been distracted drivers. There's all kind of things that we're rubbernecking about, but now we have to deal with distracted walking. And New York City may consider a ban to have walking and texting as some sort of, crime. And have we gotten to that point? I'm kind of leaning in that direction. Technology has definitely surpassed our humanity. I'm going to talk about that a little bit later in this episode. And then along the lines of all this technology that's our friend, I've noticed that my email is way out of hand. I have more junk mail than I get in the snail mail that's coming in the front door. I find that fascinating. And however, I was able to fish out a couple things that weren't garbage, and one of them was from my alma mater, Northeastern Illinois University, and as a distinguished alum, they're probably looking for some cash, as a distinguished alum, they wanted me to share my college success story because I've been so successful, and they think that they're responsible for that. Anyway, I want to talk about some of the lessons I've learned since college and in college. I was in college the first year in 19... None of your business. I'll get to that a little bit later. I was in the car today. I was not distracted, but I was using the phone. Have you noticed those are like rolling offices at this point? All I can do, hands-free. I'm hands-free. Clicked in. I got a phone call from a friend of mine. We had a long conversation about presidential candidates because both of us know someone who's running for the highest office in the land. And we can't believe that they're doing it. And it's like everything else, when you look behind the scenes and you pull back the curtain and you find out who the Wizard of Oz really is, it's kind of a shocker. I'll talk about that. I'm working on this new book, and many of the chapters in there have as an underlying theme these synchronistic events that I find even more fascinating now than I did when they actually happened, maybe because I'm writing about it so many years later. We'll talk about that. One of my favorite segments, it's brand new, kind of, we'll do true and false. Is it true or false that Joe Biden, who wants to be the president of the United States, says that Roe versus Wade went too far? We're going to find out on that. And of course, another episode of Earth Matters with Hello, I'm Bill Curtis. So stick around, stay tuned, hold on to your lug nuts. It's time for an overhaul. So a little bit different open to the show. I want to give full credit on this. And I got to say, like everything else, I get used to doing things one certain way. And when it comes to radio and production, I have the ways that I like to put things together. For the most part, when I do the Life 2.0 podcast, I do all the, ranting and raving back and forth and all those pieces. And I go back and edit the crap out of it. And I try to be a one-cut kid as best I can because I don't want to spend an inordinate, there's your word of the day, inordinate, I love that word, or too much time, for those of you not willing to crack a dictionary and figure out what it is, or Wikipedia, or encyclopedia. Is there even such a thing as an encyclopedia? I don't think so. That's what Wikipedia is, right? Most of the people I knew had an incredible set of Encyclopedia Britannica. We had white ones, I think, and green ones. And now you can't pay people to haul those out. There's nothing much. It's astonishing, really, how technology has changed. But anyway, we went to the Oak Park Farmers Market last Sunday, and it's a nice little deal they got going there. I'd never been to that one before. Very well populated, beautiful morning. And, they got your heirloom tomatoes, and somebody's making some jellies, and there's some sort of hemp t-shirts and all the cool stuff that you'd want. Went around the corner by the church, and they had donuts. They had sugar donuts and plain donuts. I'll eat any kind of donut, basically. So I got a coffee and a donut, and I heard this music, and I happened to look over past the crowd and over back behind the church up against like a garage under a huge tree, there was probably a dozen or more gentlemen and ladies that were playing music, and it was all bluegrass kind of thing. And I felt I was like 1908 again. It was just kind of really very nice. And I stood there drinking my coffee, and I'm eating one of the 17 donuts I bought that were fantastic. And I happened to notice off to the back corner, right near the garage, there's this gray-haired gentleman with some, you know, spectacles on. And I thought, that's Charlie Meyerson. I know who that is. Now, I've never met Charlie in person. It's one of those virtual friendships that we've all become used to in the landfill of Facebook. And Charlie, really, in Chicago, is one of those guys. It is a formidable player when it comes to broadcasting and journalism. He's done some amazing things. But the most important part for me is Charlie won a National Edward R. Murrow Award. Edward R. Murrow is one of my heroes. This is a guy who just put the coals to the politicians, especially when it came to McCarthy and the whole McCarthyism thing. That was when I think was the most shining moment and platform for journalism back in the day. And now there's a big award named after him. So anybody gets a Murrow Award has my attention. Charlie's that guy. So anyways, playing music there, and I've got to go say hi. And I go back there, and then we start talking. And in 5 minutes, we've basically fixed everything wrong with broadcasting, the media business, all the rest of it. We're going back and forth on stuff. And then who do I notice sitting over playing the fiddle, the violin, is Eric Zorn, the vaunted Tribune columnist. So it was a really interesting morning. And to see these guys and everybody else there kind of, you know, part of the community and doing their thing was very cool. So we went back and forth, and Charlie listened to some of my podcasts, and he sent me a note, and he said, hey, you know, here's some things that you might want to consider changing up. And so I did. Not easy for me. I'm so used to doing the shows. You heard the music started out, and I'd get right on a roll and all the guys. So I tried to do something a little bit different. For me, it's like a new muscle. I like the idea of a bit of a ramp up, and then we'll jump into stuff, and we'll see where it goes from there. So, Charlie, if you're listening, I did it, at least this one time. We'll see how it works after that. As you heard me mention in the little ramp-up open there, distracted driving, of course, has been a major problem since you put a human in a car. What is new is that the cars are bigger and heavier, and you can do more damage with them. And the other thing that, of course, we've added to this is the whole cell phone thing. And technology is not always our friend. I am 100% convinced of that. This is from the State Farm website when it comes to, I'm giving them props. They're not an advertiser or anything, but I'm just giving them props. This is where it came from, State Farm. The numbers illustrating the dangers of cell phone use while driving are downright startling. Put downright in a sentence and you got me hooked. In fact, at any given time throughout the day, approximately 660,000 drivers, good thing there's not 666,000 drivers, because then you know who's really driving. 660,000 drivers are attempting to use their phones while behind the wheel of an automobile. Now, I'll do that on occasion when the phone rings, hands-free, click in. Rare is it that I have to use the phone on my ear if something, you know, something comes in at the last second. But anyway, smartphones have made it easy for us to stay connected, but can pose serious safety risks if you start checking your text messages. So here's the deal. The National Safety Council reports that cell phones use while driving leads to 1.6 million crashes per year. Nearly 390,000 injuries occur each year from accidents caused by texting while driving. One out of every four accidents in the United States is caused by texting and driving. Texting while driving is six times more likely to cause an accident than driving drunk. That got me. Answering a text takes away your attention for about 5 seconds. At 55 miles an hour, that's enough time to travel the length of a football field. Texting while driving causes a 400% increase in time spent with eyes off the road. Of all cell phone-related tasks, texting by far is the most dangerous activity. 94% of drivers support a ban on texting while driving. 74% of drivers support a ban on handheld cell phone use. But this is what happens, and you've heard me talk on this podcast many times about specific adaptation-imposed demands. The influx and input of cell phones and what they are in our lives is such a force that we've adapted to, you know, involving them in nearly every part of our lives. So this is when I was growing up, we got distracted driving because Bohemian Rhapsody came out and you start shaking your head, you know, and it was the radio or food, eating. Now you combine the radio and food and the phone and texting, and it's amazing to me that we don't cause more havoc. In all of that, what about people walking down the street? We've seen these Walking Dead, right? So I make fun of them because I'm not one of them. Oh, that was pretty good. I make fun of them because I'm not one of them. The last thing, I got enough things that make me look like sometimes a lower life form here. The very last thing I'm going to do is walk around downtown in any street, especially here in Chicago, looking down at my phone and walk into a pole or a building or another human being or the bus stop. I've seen it all the time. So once again, here's this technology that is surpassing our humanity. Our common sense is gone. Well, in New York City, apparently, it's a bigger problem than it is even here in Chicago. Texting while walking is so dangerous, it should be outlawed. That's the case that one New York State lawmaker is making as he proposes new fines on pedestrians who use their mobile devices while crossing the street. The proposed bill from State Senator John Liu, who represents a portion of Queens in New York City, calls for fines between $25 and $50 for the first-time offender and $100 for the second time, and a whopping $250 if you do it again. So here's the question. Can a fine on distracted walking really cut? I mean, is it going to change anything? Now, Liu falls in line with me. He says this is really about common sense. And I don't know what prompted him to, you know, somebody walk into him a couple times, or he was sitting at the light and saw people walking by not paying attention. While overall traffic deaths in New York apparently fell to a record low of 200 back in 2018, 114 of those were pedestrians killed in traffic who weren't paying attention, an increase up from 107 the year before. So this is a well-intentioned bill. I'm not sure. You know, we have a hard time in this country of politicians and others telling us what is for our best interest. I know people, not so much as I used to, because of the dinger keeps going off in your car, that are adamant that the government's not going to tell me how to wear a seatbelt. Then you go flying through the windshield and you want to know why you didn't listen. The idea of a phone, great. But I grew up making sure I had a dime in my pocket. And I didn't have to check in with anybody until it was like dinner time and we just went out about our business. And the world was okay. I don't know it was any, I mean, I didn't know we needed these things. And now they are everywhere and they're not going away. So in my time, I started thinking about all the devices that I didn't have growing up and how much better I felt. And then I feel more like I got, you could get four lines for $100, limited time only. I don't care. There's a portion of people who don't care, right? I have a friend of mine, let's put it this way, who still has a flip phone and a real new flip phone in a box as a backup, right? And do you need more than that? And I don't even know why they call them phones. The last thing I do is make a phone call. Here's what I call them. ELS, electronic life support. These are electronic life support devices. You take this away from somebody and they're freaking out. It's just, it's really become like a parasitic twin for humanity. So I'm all about doing the best I can to make sure that I'm not distracted whilst driving 3,500 pounds of metal at 65 miles an hour on the Eisenhower. I shouldn't say that because that's not the speed limit, but you get my drift. But distracted walking, you see it everywhere. And then you wonder about how else this affects us when we're constantly looking instead of up, but down. And this little square that holds so much information, there is more technology on my cell phone than there was in the first lunar module. That kind of scares me. It really, really, really does. So, you know, that's going on. And I started looking at those pieces thinking, you know, we're not the brightest bulbs in the box. Humans are not the only species on the planet. We just think it. And I just find these things so obviously scary and weird and I can't do anything about them. And so hence they fall into the Wednesday rant. Another piece of the internet landfill here is my email inbox. And one of the reasons I got rid of my johnstaugustine.com, I got more influx of email with an RU or .ru ending in it, which was Russian. And I'd get first 100, then 200, then 400, then 800 emails a day. And no matter how I tried to, you know, circumvent that or put up some sort of firewall protection or all the other crap they come up with, it didn't work. And I got tired of trying to clean these emails. I said, done with it. So I got rid of that. And I don't know if it was a target or not because I'm, you know, in the media and people, I have no idea. But it got to be a pain in my keister. So I got rid of it. Now my email box is much more manageable, but there's still that junk file. And if you have a drunk drawer in your kitchen or in your living room or somewhere where you keep all that stuff. You know, you open up, you're like, oh, why don't I ever clean this out? Because that's how it's supposed to be. Junk's in there. And sometimes you got to go find stuff and you know exactly where it is. And when I open the junk email, I can see all this stuff that comes in. I find it fascinating. And anyway, there was one in there that shouldn't have been in there from Northeastern Illinois University, where I went to college, graduated back in 92, started there in 77. And as a distinguished alumni, they wanted me to share my college success story as an inspirational moment for other college people or alumni, I'm not really sure. And I had to, I started cracking up. Because I don't know, and when I read their little invite, it was like, okay, so we want you to share how you succeeded and how Northeastern played a role in that. So here's what here's some of the things that crossed my mind, and I thought I would just kind of throw that out. It isn't what it used to be. That is for sure. It is a business now. And once they figured they can, and they is a very broad term, once they, the nefarious they, figured out that we can, you know, hang the carrot and the stick out for college kids and, you know, tack on serious college debt and make money that way, you know, it was over. The game was over then. All of a sudden now it's a business and who's going to go where, and it's all based on how good your football team is and all the rest of that stuff. But for me, I was hard-pressed to figure out how the actual college or the university or anything that I was doing made a difference in what I do now, because it is nothing. What I do have been doing for 22 years has nothing to do, and you hear this all the time, with the degree that I got, pretty much. It was a communications degree, environmental communication and interpretation. I'm very big on research and digging into stuff and then being able to convert that into some sort of medium that people can learn from and be inspired by, so there's that. But I never took any journalism classes, and I never took, surely didn't go on the radio there. I don't know if they had a radio station back then. I think they did. But all of that being said, I couldn't find a college success story. I mean, I had the perseverance to stick around and finish. Let's put it that way. I started in 1977. At that point, Animal House was still a year or two away from being on the big screen, but I'm pretty sure that when Dean Wormer says, 3 C's and an F, you know, there's no way to go through college, son. He was talking to me, even though it was in that movie. So I started in 77, and kids came along and, you know, that type of thing, and I had gotten married. And so I really kept staying with it until I was able to work into an adult education program, and I finished. I was very proud of that part, but I've finished a lot of things, breakfast, lunch, dinner. It wasn't this overarching, oh my gosh, because I went to this school, my life is somehow anointed or better. And I'm very proud of being an alumni there, that's for sure, mostly because I finished. And in all of that, over the years, I kept thinking that is one of the things that was really important. And if I had to pay college tuition to learn that lesson, I might have missed the lesson itself. So it was very funny when I got that. And I started to be thinking about all that I've accomplished since I left there. If you would have told me in 1992 that the bottom would drop out for me in 96, business-wise, that I'd end up living with my family in a motel in Upper Michigan, that I would walk in 1996 from the Upper Peninsula border to Chicago and back, and that I would live in that motel with them for a year, and then the next year I would decide that I'm going on the radio in August of 97, and that I would do that, then I'd start moving forward, and I'd, you know, syndication would have, all this stuff would happen. You know, there's no way to know all those things. So I don't know that college prepared me for the work that lie ahead. What I did find and figure out is that it was almost the reverse. Most of the things that I go into, I've kind of had an idea that there was something in there for me that I needed to know. I just didn't know what it was. That there was, I didn't go into college with this, I'm going to do X and then I'll have Y. I wasn't ever that smart. I just knew I had to go. Started out first because I had a football scholarship. But see, there's always that synchronicity in there. There's something that kept me moving in that direction. And I have been so aware, even more than I have in a very, very long time, about the synchronistic events in my life. I'm working on this book. I've been at it for a long time, at least 17 years in my mind. And some of this stuff unfurls all these years later, and I'm writing about it. And I wanted to share that because I think as the chaos of the world grabs our attention all the time, and those headlines are begging for us to go digging in them, the lifelines are found in the synchronistic events that guide our path. It has always been that way for me. Synchronicity was first introduced by Carl Jung. He held that events are meaningful coincidences if they occur with no casual relationship, yet seem to be meaningfully related. And that's really the key. Humans, above all other animals, get to decide what something means or what it doesn't. You can lose your job, it's the best thing ever happened, or you can blow your brains out. I mean, we are the choice versus chance opportunity is always there. We get to decide what something means. So for me, when I look at the connected dots that even allow me today to sit here and do this podcast, they're incalculable on some level. And so this concept that these ideas, these coincidences have meaning behind them, I'm still digging to see maybe they have meaning behind them because I decide they have meaning behind them. And then because I've decided that, there's some sort of energetic trade-off or go-between or interaction that another one occurs. And how's this happen? So case in point, the book I'm writing is called Phenomenon, Sacred Moments, Messages, Memories, and Other Shit That I Can't Explain. And I put a little asterisk where the I is in the word shit because they don't like... See, you can say shit all day. Put shit on the front of a book, people are like, oh my God, shit's on the front of the book. Don't want that. So it's S-H and a little, you know, asterisk T, so it's the word shit, but I kind of took the I out. Don't want to offend anybody because no one else has heard the word shit in their lifetime, right? So this book is about, for the most part, a lot of these events and these connected dots that have happened. And one of the ones that I had not planned including in this book that comes out June or July was about a young girl that I met when she was 8 years old, and she was dying of brain cancer. She was terminal. And I was working back then with Walter Payton, the late great running back for the Chicago Bears. He had already retired. And my daughter, coincidentally, just months earlier, was diagnosed with kidney disease. So there was an effort underway to do some funding around the bills that we had to pay because this was going to be something back then wasn't covered. It was a pre-existing condition. Remember those? Don't get me started on those. Pre-existing conditions. I'm trying not to get derailed here. You know, just you can call it Obamacare. I don't care what care you call it. But there's a huge set. Everybody's got something going on, and you'll never get a one-size-fits-all, so you have to do the best you can with what you got where you are. And so going back to the good old days where everything was privatized and there was no such thing, they could tell you no right now without any reason because you had a pre-existing condition. And I battled left and right. And part of that was to do a fundraising dinner, and Walter and some of his friends were going to be at an event, and the money raised would help offset some of the costs that we were absorbing with my daughter's kidney challenges. Luckily, I was forceful enough to get the insurance company eventually. I bent them to my will, and they were agreed to pay some things that they said they wouldn't pay before. I don't know what... You can only threaten them so far, but it worked out. Didn't have to do that event, but we had created a flyer. And that flyer was a pink piece of paper. I still have one or two of them. My daughter's picture in the middle, and it's Walter and friends, and it's a fundraiser. And they were all ready to go, thank you know who, that we didn't have to use it. I'm working with Walter, and I've been passing the desk of his assistant three or four times during the day, and on the corner of the desk is a piece of paper that looks so similar to the one we created, I couldn't believe it wasn't the same. The only thing that was different was the girl's face on the front, and her name was Amy. And I went back and forth, and finally the third or fourth time I just picked it up. And I looked at it, and it was a fundraising dinner. She was in gravely ill, 8 years old and not expected to live, and her family was, you know, really under it. And what they wanted was an autographed football for their event. So I took it to Walter, and I said, you know, you think about signing a football for these folks, and it would be a good thing. And he said, I'll sign it if you bring it there. I don't want to mail it. You take it to the event. The event was in September. This was like in July. And I read, sure, I'll go. And I already had an inkling like maybe I should be there, and then he confirmed it. So I called the organizer of the event, and she was ecstatic that, you know, that the ball would be there. And she said, you know, I want you to talk to Sue, who is Amy's mom, and, you know, you two should connect. And okay, fine. And we're still a few months away. So I got a phone call from Sue a couple weeks later, and she invited me to come to the event because I still wasn't convinced I should go there. And that was the third confirmation. So now I got, you know, the flyer sitting on the desk. I ignored it. I look at it. I get it. I go to Walter. He says go. I'm like, yeah, okay, whatever. I get this feeling I should go. I kind of ignore that. Sue says, please come. Okay. And eventually I did go there. And it was an incredible, life-changing thing. This little 8-year-old girl, because of her difficulty and illness, somehow got 300 of us to get in the room that were all very different. And I realized quickly when I went in, there was this huge picture. Her confirmation picture was up on the wall. And I just had this overwhelming thought, because there's a sixth sense we all have if we use it, which we usually don't, that'll kick in. And if you pay attention to that, it'll give you some insight into what's going on. And it was this overwhelming feeling of, she's going to be okay. We're all here to witness and see ourselves different. That's how I felt. Very strange. Gave him the football. The dinner was incredible. I gave a speech. You can read about all that in the book later. I'm not going to get into all that now. And about 3 or 4 days later, I was substitute teaching at Schurz High School, where I went to school in the city here. And I was asked to cover a class. And it was great because it was on the second floor, literally like the next classroom down from the lunchroom. And if, right after fourth period, I could hit the lunchroom before any of the other teachers get there and get some nice peach cobbler. So I had it all figured out. So I go to the class. I open the door. The bell rings. Nobody shows up. Not one kid in the classroom. Now, they know there's a sub. I don't know where they went. It's not my problem. They're just not there. But I have to stay in that room. So I sat there. I left the door open for a while, read the paper, and then I started rummaging around in the teacher's desk because, you know, they always got goodies or candies in there somewhere. And they're usually in the bottom right-hand drawer because most people are right-handed, so they're bottom right-hand drawer. And I went through the top drawer and the whole thing, and I get to the bottom right-hand drawer. There's no candies. I slide open the top left-hand drawer, and there is about 6 or 7 or 8 pages stapled together. And on the top of the paper, the front page, it says, Keeping Hope Alive. And there's this whole article stapled together talking about this herbal supplement, this tea basically, that is effective against cancer. And I'm flipping through going, what the world? And I get to the 4th or 5th page and highlighted in yellow highlighter, it says, this tea is especially effective against brainstem tumors. The very same thing that Amy was dying from. And I didn't know what to do with that. What are the odds that I'd go in that day and cover that class? And nobody, if those kids were there, I would have never started digging in the drawers. I'd be too busy. And the little bell went off. This is what she's dying from. What is this doing in here? What am I doing in here? So I made copies of it and I highlighted the same thing and put the original back in there. And I went to lunch when the period was over, and I went home. And that night I was in agony. I was in agony because I didn't know if I should share this with them or not. I know what it's like to have a very ill child. And when somebody is critically ill, a lot of people come out of the woodwork with a lot of information. It's hard to absorb. You don't want to make it any more difficult. And that was my pivot point. I'm like, they're already under the gun. I don't know anything about this stuff. I found it in a drawer 2 days after I gave a talk at this event where this little girl is probably not going to live to see Christmas. And I hesitated and I did something I don't know that I have ever done since, maybe once. I'm not a religious person. I like to just pay attention and kind of feel the whole energy of what's going on. And I think that the Almighty and the Creator shows up in a lot of ways we miss. But I literally got on my knees and did the Catholic thing, which is very rare for me. And I prayed and I said, I need some help here because this is kicking my ass. The odds of me finding this piece of paper are infinitesimal. And I don't want to hurt these people anymore if it's not good for them. So finally, I let that go. I called Terry, who was the organizer. I told him, you hang up the phone, you call them now. And I did. Sue answered the phone. I rambled about this whole thing. I told her what was going on, and she burst into tears. And she said, John, we've been praying for something. And the way that it's coming through you and all this is something I need to look into. Wow. So I mailed it to her, regular mail. There was no such thing as email. This was 1994. I mailed it to her. She called a few days later, said they were going to implement this herbal supplement, this herbal tea into Amy's protocol. It wasn't going to make anything worse. She literally was told to go home and be comfortable. And the little girl that I saw on that stage that night at that event, she was so weak. When we were all done talking and raising money, she came out with her dad, John, and they walked up to the podium. It was like, for me, she was standing there choosing her words so carefully because she was so sick. Like, she didn't want to waste energy on one word that wasn't needed. And it was almost like somebody was talking in her ear. She was getting a download. And I don't remember her words. I just remember, if I close my eyes, I'm doing it right now, I could see her standing at that podium up on a, like a booster kind of setup, because she was so frail and small. So they added this to the protocol. And I thought, well, I kind of just did my job. You know, I mean, this has nothing to do with about me. I just covered a class, and I looked in a drawer because I'm hoping a Snickers is in there. And the odds of that being in there are just ridiculous. Months went by. Didn't hear anything. Almost a year, I think, went by. And I'm not going to bother these folks. I kind of felt a few times maybe Amy passed away and they just didn't want to call and tell me. Every now and again, I'd look at the paper in the obituaries, and if she wasn't in there, I didn't see her name, then I thought maybe that's okay. Literally almost a year goes by. And I get a phone call one day. I wasn't in the house 5 minutes. The phone's ringing. One of those deals. I walk in, and there it is. And Sue's on the phone, and she was crying her eyes out saying, the tumors have shrunk significantly. Now, I am not a scientist. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a doctoral scientist. I don't have any knowledge in those things, but I do know that there is some sort of a force or an energy that if we allow those things to take place, science and medicine take a back seat to all that. Amy recently celebrated her 33rd birthday. And writing the book, I reached out to Sue. I crossed paths with her and John in 2018 at an event I was doing. They walked in the door. I couldn't believe it. Hadn't seen him for years. And I didn't even want to bring up Amy's name because you never know. And they said that she's hanging in there. She just turned 33 not long ago. She's endured 19 brain surgeries, 19, and strokes, and endured many difficult days. And yet she is a testament to not only what St. Jude has helped for years with her. I mean, they have been the driving force with that. That was the medical piece put in. But I sent this chapter on purpose to Sue to have her sign off on the fact that what came out of that drawer some way, somehow, was able to support her at a time when it didn't look good. And she was all over it and absolutely. And they used that tea for many, many, many years. So my point in all this ramble is that while there's a lot of shit going on in the world that begs our attention, the synchronistic events, the connected dots, really literally the yellow brick road, does not appear until we pay attention to it. Because otherwise this stuff just falls through the cracks. And this book that I'm working on, maybe the last one I ever write, for various reasons. You know, I've written two other books, and it takes a lot out of me to do it. And there's no guarantee on the back end. This is a self-published one, which is different than the other two. I had a publishing contract, and it was money. It was great. This is different. And so throwing it out there, there's two reasons I'm doing it. Number one is I don't want to forget these things, because I have days where I forget how blessed my path has been. I'm not writing this in a way that's to say, here, you know, here's the chapter and do these four things. That's really the life coach type stuff. There's no... To me, if you really want to live an incredible life, pay attention to your life, the good and the bad. There are cosmic lessons buried in all of it. And that leads me to this politics. I hate to say this. I mean, I really do. I was thinking about earlier today, if all I could do was get out and do these Wednesday rants and talk about that kind of stuff like I did with the book and all that, that would be a whole different thing for me. The gist of what I do is to examine human behavior and learn from it and hopefully improve the human condition. That's really what it boils down to. And you cannot ignore politics, religion, sports, education, all these platforms where human behavior is totally on display 24/7, 365. So for me, it's so far less than Democrat, Republican, other, independent, liberal, conservative. Those are just labels. You know how many sub-labels are under those labels? Too many to count. So for me, all that's going on, people might hear it through a political funnel in their ear, but I'm not going in that direction. So if an independent source says that the man who is in the Oval Office now has lied over 10,000 times and they can fact check it, not just because they don't like him, I think we should pay attention to that, because then we look at how we've all lied and how important it was or wasn't important, or what's the deal, or what we put up with or won't put up with. Some of the most difficult human beings to ever deal with are usually the best teachers. So I like to look at these things as lessons to be learned. Otherwise, what's the point? It's like going to the dollar store and asking for a price check. You already know the answer. What's the point? A friend of mine called me today. I was driving, but I wasn't distracted. And we were chatting in the car, going back and forth. And he said, "Hey, I was going to call you when I heard that so-and-so wanted to be president." And I said, "Yeah, I was thinking the same thing." So my friend and I both know someone who has thrown their hat into the ring to be the president of the United States and go into the Oval Office in 2020. Wouldn't vote for him. Can't vote for him. And the reason for that is because I have information, and this friend of mine does as well, and some people that I know, that about this person that we know that it wouldn't be a good idea. And I work very diligently not to get involved in that part of it. I just try to ignore it, leave it alone. People are going to think what they want to think. And so maybe 3 months ago, I got an email from a friend of mine who was all about this candidate and talking about their great points and all the stuff that was going on with them and how they were. And I had enough. I said, "Okay." I responded. I said, "Please don't send me this anymore. Here's why this is this way for me." And I didn't cite specific events or occurrences or experiences, but I just said, "Here, I have these comments," let's put them that way, and they pertain right to firsthand knowledge and experience of dealing with this person long before they wanted to be president or thought they could be president. And I've seen them work under pressure. It wasn't good. I've seen them treat people in a certain way, and that wasn't good. And yet, I know humans across the board aren't perfect. I get it. But I will abstain at this point from any more involvement in that direction." And they thanked me. They were very surprised, but they also thanked me for being brutally honest. And one of the reasons that it kind of torqued my bolts so much is because there's this verbiage that comes out of people who are running for higher office that they really, either they believe this or some media consultant tells them that you have to say everyone. We're going to include everyone. We're going to make America great again for everyone. Everyone? And you hear this and you see this on billboards and it's going to be everyone. Well, it's never everyone. Never everyone. Never. It's never been everyone. It will never be everyone. There's a meme going around in Facebook. I wish I had it in front of me. And it's something to the effect when, remember the days when the president was respected and the police were respected and the unborn were respected? We need to get back to that. Which day was that exactly? What year, month, date, when all those things lined up? I'll wait. Never. Never. And so we have this kind of sanitized version of reality that we like it to be, or our lives have reflected. We think everyone lives that way, and they don't. Not long ago, former Vice President Joe Biden's wife was on the Today Show. She has a new book out. And Savannah Guthrie asked her a question. She said something to the effect, and I could tell it caught her off guard. You know, you're going on to push about a book, and it goes right to politics, and that's unfortunate, but it should be expected, and you should be schooled enough if you get a question like this. And this is what Savannah Guthrie basically said to Jill Biden. She said, "So what is it about your husband that we should, you know, give him the opportunity to be the president, the next president of the United States?" And Jill Biden kind of cocked her head. She goes, "He has everyone's best interests at heart. He can make life better for everybody." That's not possible. It is not possible. But it's a pat answer that comes out. And I'm thinking, well, what are we going to do? We're all going to get like on Staten Island, shove everybody in the United States there, and then sing Kumbaya? expectation and reality has never lined up. We expect things to be different. They're not. And it hurts. And we're let down. And it's difficult. And we go over to reality. And the more you deal with the reality of things, the more change you can actually make. But we're over here, we're going to get it for everybody. No. I don't have anything against Joe Biden at all. Nor do I have really anything against anyone who's legitimately wants to make things better. But you got to drop that everyone thing. There's got to be some realism to this stuff. Because then all of a sudden you're left out. If my life didn't get better because a certain president walked in, then I'm left out. Well, he didn't mean me. And that's how it is. And it runs across the board. The same thing. I'm listening to some conversation today about politics, and they were talking about the same thing, that people want to get behind a candidate that thinks they'll make their life better. Is the United States president the person that's supposed to make your life better? Is that true? I'd never heard that growing up. You know, if Lyndon Johnson gets in, you know, if Richard Nixon gets in, you know, if Ike gets in, you know, if Clinton gets in, you know, run down the list. I've never heard that really put that way. People vote for people, according to this media pundit, that they think will make their life better. I find that fascinating. I don't know why exactly, but I find that fascinating. And in all of this, it's time for truth or consequences or something along those lines. I have said this in the past. I've worn myself out digging around the vast landfill of Facebook every time somebody I know or kind of know virtually through there puts up something that's totally false and not true. And then I'm like, please don't do that. Please open up the Encyclopedia Britannica, go to the bottom and look and see if it's true. We are a very lazy species when it comes to this, and it makes it energetically very difficult for people to move forward. And there's stuff is going on all the time. And so I call people on it, not out in public. I'll just send them a little note. Please just... You can find in 5 seconds, because we have vast high-speed internet, maybe 10 seconds at the most, the answers to some of this stuff, true or false. So whether it's factcheck.org or Snopes or whatever, there's a dozen sites that you can find out if this is true. When you start realizing how odd some of this stuff is and it gets passed around anyway, I don't get it. But maybe I'm not supposed to. So here's the true or false for the day. Did Joe Biden say once that Roe versus Wade, which is the U.S. Supreme Court case that protects a pregnant woman's freedom to choose whether or not to have an abortion, went too far? Did Uncle Joe really say that Roe versus Wade went too far? True or false? I probably should use some of the sound effects that are in my editing software. But anyway, there you go. True. In 1974, Joe Biden gave a notably candid interview to the Washingtonian, a D.C. area monthly magazine. Excerpts from that profile, which painted the young U.S. senator as a conservative Democrat. How often do you hear those words together? I'm a conservative Democrat, which means there would be liberal Republicans, right? But that's a whole different show. Those comments emerged in multiple contexts after he became a candidate for the presidency just this past year. Among the many topics covered in the Washingtonian profile was the senator's view on abortion and, in general, the Roe versus Wade specifically. Speaking of that watershed 1972 U.S. Supreme Court decision, Biden did say that he felt it went too far, and here's his quote. I don't like the Supreme Court decision on abortion. I think it went too far. I don't think that a woman has the sole right to say what should happen to her body, end quote. That statement was memorialized in a meme from the 2020 presidential election. They're starting to roll this out, and there's a picture of Joe with that quote and his weird, smirky look on his face. He did say it in 1974. So I want to, feel free once this is posted to email me or make comments, because this is a little class participation. Should someone be held accountable for what they said 30 or 40 years ago? 45 years ago? It goes on to say in this article, as discussed in an earlier fact check, Biden's views on abortion rights have shifted since then. In 07, for example, Biden was given a 0% score by the Pro-Life National Right to Life Committee and a 75% score by the Pro-Choice America group. He says, I accept church rule personally, but not in public life, he said in 2012. In 2019, The anti-abortion Life Site News website announced that Biden's candidacy said it this way. Pro-abortion Joe Biden announces entry into 2020 presidential race. So, he did say back in 74 it went too far. He's changed his ideas over the year. Did he change because of politics? Did he change because of personal things that went on in his life? I don't know. But the bigger question to me is, you should hear some of the shit I said in 1974. Now, I was not running, and of course, I don't know that I'll ever run for office. I'll run from office, even though I've been asked a couple times to run for office. I've kind of negated that. For should Joe Biden be accountable for what he said in 1974? And if that's true, then should the current president be held accountable for everything he said over the years? And on that note, here's Earth Matters with Bill Curtis.
There once was a time when Amazon was just a river. Now it's much more than that. Are words confusing us when it comes to the environment? The term global warming was first used back in 1975, and for the past 39 years or so, it was an accurate way to describe the changes affecting Earth. In an attempt to make the concept more user-friendly, the term climate change came about, which is technically different than global warming, but it seemed less scary. Now comes a new way of hearing about the warming of the planet. Correct term is global climate disruption, which most accurately depicts how human impact disturbs weather patterns and contributes to unprecedented storms and drought. It might go by different names, but one thing is for certain, everyone is affected by it. I'm Bill Curtis, and Earth Matters.
So are words confusing us? I think they really are. You know, growing up, I used the word shit like I used the word spaghetti, which I think I'm having for dinner tonight. And my dad used to say, you know, the only difference between shit and spaghetti is who cooks it and how it tastes. And so I think words could be swords or saviors. I think that it's easy to get hung up on these things. I did one show where, you know, I mean, when I grew up, catfish was a real fish. It wasn't a television show where people come up with fake profiles to lure people, you know, to some weird relationships. That's called bullshit. You want to look up bullshit, you'd find that stuff. A catfish is a fish in the water. You catch it, then you let it go, and it's got barbels and all this stuff. So maybe we are having a difficult time with the words, but global warming, climate change, all the rest of that stuff. And I've been working on environmental stuff for 30-plus years. As a research guy, I'd like to find out behind the scenes. If you ever are connected to me on Facebook and you see when I do Sacred Sunday songs, it's kind of my frustrated attempt at being a disc jockey. I like the stories behind the stories more than the actual songs themselves sometimes. Where the impetus came, how they were written, what were the meaning. You know, the only person that really knows what American Pie means is Don McLean. The rest of us just sing it like we wrote it. Maybe that's the whole point. Anyway, thanks so much for spending time with me today. And until next time, safe travels, be well, adios.